from St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. After an acrimonious end to the 2025 Missouri General Assembly session, lawmakers are returning to Jefferson City next week to deal with three sets of issues laid out by Missouri Governor Mike Kehoe. But on the latest episode of Politically Speaking, Democratic State Senator Tracy McCreary of St. Louis County explains why some of these ideas may not pass muster with her caucus or the state's voters. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
Let's go back to some of those policies, to that peace and prosperity that we had some 4 to 5 years ago.
Everywhere is Democratic country once this Democrat's been there.
There are a lot of things in Washington that are very bipartisan, including some bills that I've already gotten passed.
And I think it works best when you can see both sides, but you have to pick one, and I firmly align with the Republicans.
But certainly, I think if she's running against one of the crazy dudes, certainly it's going to be a lot easier.
But I'll take wisdom and age and a few missteps in oratory over somebody who has no substance.
I believe that you represent the party's values and you move forward, and that's what I have done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I am your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum, joining us from beautiful and scenic and rugged mid-Missouri. She covers state government and state politics for St. Louis Public Radio.
Sarah Kellogg.
And joining us in studio right now, she represents Missouri's beautiful and rugged and scenic 24th Senatorial District.
Tracy McCreary.
Is Fenton in your district?
It is, yes.
I was just there a couple days ago, and it is definitely rugged in the sense that there are a lot of like warehouses and factories there.
Well, and very hilly neighborhoods. It's always a leg day when I'm out talking to voters in Fenton.
Very much so. So let's just jump right into it. You next week, the legislature's coming back for what I would call a very packed and substantive special session. Sarah, is that a fair description?
I think that's very fair. Three pretty big issues to tackle, including storm relief, the stadium, as well as some failed capital projects that were in a failed budget bill that are, I guess, rising from the dead.
We will talk about each of those individually, but Senator, what are your general impressions of Governor Kehoe's decision to call this multifaceted special session?
Well, I'm stunned that he would do such a thing. First of all, Governor Kehoe had a chance to get this done during our regular session and was unable to get people in his own party to function as statespeople and come to some agreement on some other issues. So this could have all been taken care of and not be wasting taxpayer money by calling a special session.
Given how acrimonious the end of session was, specifically how Republicans forcibly cut off Democratic filibusters aimed at protecting voter-approved paid sick leave and abortion measures, which, by the way, we're going to talk about in more detail later in the show, do you think that Senate Democrats will forgive and forget?
Well, this isn't just about Senate Democrats. So, you know, what happened in the last week of session on that Wednesday, two full days before session really needed to end, was Republican politicians told Senate Democrats that they needed to shut up and sit down because the majority party was just going to do what they wanted. But it wasn't just the Republican politicians telling Senate Democrats to shut up and sit down. They told 1.6 million Missouri voters who voted for increasing the minimum wage and for allowing people to gradually earn a little bit of paid sick time. They told those folks to shut up and sit down as well, and that their vote didn't matter. So, you know, what happened in that last week of session is really an affront to voters all over the state of Missouri.
Governor Kehoe alluded to the testy end of the regular session during his Tuesday press conference. Here's a clip of that.
I know it can be tough to move on from disagreements and failed negotiations, but we must. As I said in our State of the State address, Missourians didn't send us here to work for ourselves. We are here to serve them. The relationship we build here and the way we treat each other is far more important than any praise, headline, or social media viral moment.
That was Governor Mike Kehoe at a press conference on Tuesday after announcing the multi-pronged special session. You know, he also said that he wasn't expecting senators to forget, but to kind of look at the goals of the session. What do you think about that?
Well, those are just words as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, I listened to that entire press conference on Tuesday. And one of the things that I think got lost in that is that the governor and Republican politicians were already determined to come back for a special session so that we could figure out a way to give, you know, rich, wealthy owners of stadiums some kind of giveaway. And the governor, in his press announcement of calling the special session, made it sound like he was doing that because he cared so deeply about people that lost so much in the tornadoes in, you know, that in mid-May. And I just think that that is that as an elected official, I know in my heart why the special session is being called, and it's being called so that the legislature can consider giveaways for the Chiefs and the Royals.
Breaking down the special session even further, Keogh is calling for a tax deduction to take into account insurance deductibles that people pay for tornado damage. He also wants to expand the scope of the Missouri Housing Trust Fund, which is administered by the Missouri Housing Development Commission, to potentially help tornado victims. These don't seem overly controversial. What are your thoughts about them?
Well, I don't think they're overly controversial either, but we also have to be realistic and take a look around at some of the neighborhoods that were destroyed by the tornado. There are people, homeowners, that aren't insured. There are people, homeowners and renters, that aren't going to benefit from an income tax deduction or even any kind of income tax credit. So, you know, this tornado that struck St. Louis City and a little bit of St. Louis County was extremely destructive. And for the governor to put a cap of $25 million on, you know, help, and with no mention of it going specifically to St. Louis City, I think that is just a drop in the bucket and is kind of insulting to the people who have experienced such great loss.
And it's worth noting that since the insurance deductible plan is a tax deduction and not a tax credit, it wouldn't likely provide an extreme amount of money to people. So I did the math before this show started. If someone has $100,000 of taxable income, and for some reason their deductibles are so high that they would pay $5,000 in deductibles to repair their home or replace their car, which often doesn't happen. It's usually around $2,500 or $500 for your car. You would get like $250, $240 from that from the state, which isn't nothing. But it kind of highlights the fact that if there's going to be a response to this, the federal response is going to be more important, because people could get tens of thousands of dollars from FEMA if they qualify. What do you think about that point?
Well, that's exactly right. I think that, you know, the governor and his advisors are trying to package, you know, they're trying to make this stadium funding scheme more presentable to the public, and they're trying to mask it in some kind of, you know, empathetic community response to a storm. And I just think that the voters can see right through this.
So, as we alluded to, another part of this special session is kind of resurrects some of House Bill 19, which was a host of capital improvement projects across the state. And that legislation died after the House declined to take up the bill, not even vote on it, citing long-term costs to the state. And Keogh said that the special session wouldn't include the entirety of House Bill 19. He actually doesn't really want to spend. He's restricting and basically saying no GR spending, with just a couple exceptions. And it even reduces some of the appropriations. Do you think that's going to fly with senators?
Well, it's not going to fly with me, and that's who I speak for. You know, the interesting thing is House Bill 19 was part of the package of budget bills that had to be to the governor by that first Friday in May. So everything that was in House Bill 19, the capital improvement budget, was part of the negotiations for the complete budget package. So although these are standalone bills, everything was negotiated big picture as far as budget and appropriations debate. So I don't see how you can have a bill that was part of a negotiated package never be brought up, so it failed, and then to use those same items in there to renegotiate on something else. To me, that's double dipping at the extreme, and I just think that's unacceptable. The only way to remedy House Bill 19 going down during regular session is to bring everything back up in that, because all of that had been negotiated and was part of the deal.
You know, there's given data showing that we may be headed towards a recession, and the fact that the federal funding that propped up the state budget is now pretty much gone and has to be spent by the end of 2026. Do people like House Budget Chairman Dirk Deaton have a point that it may not be a good idea to spend lots of money that may be needed for core state governmental services?
Well, you know what? Maybe that representative should have mentioned that in the hearings and in the negotiations and in all of the discussions, rather than ambush his colleagues in the state Senate by just, you know, doing something sly last minute and, you know, undercutting all of the goodwill and statesperson-like behavior that had been going on for 5 months.
And also, I know this was a point that Senator Lincoln Huff pointed out the last week of session, which was, you know, declining to pass House Bill 19 in lieu of budget concerns, but then the House turning around and passing this this stadium funding bill, which we're going to get to in a second. You know, does that kind of put a bad taste in your mouth? You know, I know Huff said, you know, pretty hypocritical kind of thoughts on that argument, but then to turn around and fund a stadium bill.
Right. And, you know, Senator Huff said in on the Senate floor that last week of session that, you know, House Republican politicians wouldn't spend $1.2 million for a rural hospital in Pemiscot County, but now they want to spend hundreds of millions of dollars building stadiums. That seems a little hypocritical to me. I agree with Senator Huff. That seems really, really hypocritical.
Okay, so we've mentioned this 60 times already, but let's get to the topic we're all waiting for, which is Kehoe wanting lawmakers to pass an incentive package to keep the Kansas City Royals and the Kansas City Chiefs in Missouri. Here is what he had to say about that plan during his press conference.
For months, we have worked with legislators, local leaders, and teams to make sure that Missouri has a competitive package on the table. We believe this financing tool, the Show Me State Sports Investment Act, is a competitive offer, but also a good deal for Missouri taxpayers. The money dedicated for the bond payments are up to the amount of revenues historically generated by the teams. This is the same amount of revenue the state stands to lose if either team relocates to any other state.
That was Governor Kehoe again about the Royals and Chiefs incentive package. Senator, you are a very public skeptic of the 2015 bid to build a Rams Riverfront Stadium, which would have included state bonding. Are you a skeptic of this? I mean, the answer is yes, because you have just said you were. But like,
obviously, I'm skeptical, and I'm no expert. So when I'm not an expert on something, I turn to people that are experts. And I've not seen a legitimate economist ever say that public funding, taxpayer funding of stadium deals are good for the taxpayers. So, you know, I'm in the show me state now. I think I'm going to have to be shown how this is such a good deal. And, you know, the other thing that that is interesting in what Kehoe said is it's this premise that the stadium financing package seems to be to let the teams keep the taxes that they generate. So if that's truly what we're going to do here in the state of Missouri, then why wouldn't we take taxes generated in the city of St. Louis and St. Louis County and keep those taxes for ourselves and use those to rebuild the communities impacted by the tornado? This is a really slippery slope. If we're talking about being able to keep tax money and do with it what we want, you know, I could make a case that why should St. Louis City and St. Louis County taxpayers that pay a lot into the state of Missouri, we're doing things, we're funding the foundation formula for schools in rural Missouri. We're helping to pay sheriffs in rural parts of the state. Why don't we let St. Louis City and St. Louis County keep that tax money and help rebuild our communities that have been so devastated by the tornado?
So let me be clear about something before I make this point. People who were questioning the financial wisdom of the 2015 stadium, they were right to do that, because even the biggest supporters of this stadium told me the best case scenario was that the city, and I'm talking about St. Louis City because it was only St. Louis City offering money, would break even. And I don't think the state was ever going to recoup the money that it was going to give. So I'm not blaming the Kansas City lawmakers that joined you for questioning the wisdom of this stadium. But what I've been like harping on for the last year is that the biggest critics of that idea, besides you, besides people like Rob Vescovo, who also was part of the lawsuit that you were on, were Kansas City lawmakers.
Right.
And it's just sort of like, I get that like very few of them are in the legislature anymore, and some of them were questioning the process and not necessarily public funding. But you have to have some thoughts about this turnabout a decade later. I certainly do.
Well, it's definitely very interesting. And, you know, unfortunately, because of term limits, some of the folks, some of the Kansas City politicians who were so vocal in not wanting to help the St. Louis region are no longer in office. But, you know, economic development, giving handouts to wealthy team owners under the, you know, and support, you know, calling it economic development is really just not anything that the taxpayers are supportive of. And I hope that people can remove or tamp down their emotion as it relates to sports teams like the Chiefs and the Royals and try to remember who we are and who sent us to office. And that is, you know, we were sent to the Missouri legislature by voters who are taxpayers, and they want us to make sure that we're making the best and most wisest decision with the taxpayer money.
So here's the big question that you may not reveal on this show, but, you know, if you do, this will be a lot of fun for me. This cannot pass without Democratic votes, because it's almost a certainty that some Republicans will vote against it. I've seen some Republicans on social media, like Senator Nick Schroer of St. Charles County, Senator Joe Nicola of Jackson County. I think they expressed real questions about this because the skepticism about stadium funding is bipartisan. There are Republicans that don't like it. There are Democrats that don't like it. They can't use the PQ in this situation because they would be PQing their own members.
Well, I wouldn't put it past them. You know, that, you know, they were very frustrated with a Republican's filibuster over former Senator Schatz being put on as the Franklin County commissioner, the head of the Franklin County Commission. And so I just have no idea what's going to happen.
But what would Republicans have to offer Democrats who are, I cannot emphasize this enough, are critical for this to pass? Like, they cannot pass without the Democrats. Is there anything they can offer for you to stand down on
this?
Well,
I've not heard from anybody, so that's pretty telling.
Well, and also a situation is the difference is in theory, Democrats could just sit down, you know, not filibuster and say, go find your votes, and they wouldn't be able to come up with them. So it isn't even the matter of a PQ. It's just getting the votes in the first place.
You don't even have to do that much work on this if you don't want to, basically.
Well, I think that we all got elected to office for a reason, and that is to use our voice. And, you know, I am going to be standing up for a sensible use of taxpayer money. And, you know, that's all I can comment on as far as what I'm going to be doing during special session.
We need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll continue this politically speaking conversation with Senator Tracy McCreary. And we're back on Politically Speaking with State Senator Tracy McCreary, who represents Missouri's 24th senatorial district. Now, on to other things that happened during this session. Sarah, there were a lot of things that happened in this session beyond the last week that I think we'd like to discuss with the senator. Why don't you start us off?
Absolutely. You know, early in the session, lawmakers passed a public safety bill that included putting a gubernatorial board in charge of the St. Louis Police Department. You ended up voting for this bill. What prompted you to support it?
Well, I started out being vehemently opposed to that bill, but as the process worked and the process was working properly in the state Senate at that point, there were a lot of really good public safety measures put into that bill. So I ended up being comfortable with it, and partially it was because of the hard work that the Senate Democrats did in making that bad bill better. And it also, you know, one of the reasons I ended up being comfortable with it is because it did allow for the senators who represent the city of St. Louis to have the ability to sponsor them and put them through the Senate confirmation process. So to me, that's as close as you can get to local control without having local control. So the state senators, in this case, Senator Carl LeMay and Senator Steve Roberts, they're going to have the ultimate say as far as who gets to sit on that board.
I do have a follow-up on this point, and this is a very speculative point, but will not be a speculative point after 2032. There is going to come a time when the 4th District Senator is going to be from St. Louis County. It might be next year when Gina Minton wins that, and it may be after in 2032, that district's going to be 80-20 county. Do you have any concern about a county senator having so much say over a city police board?
Well, the person that would get appointed to the board still has to live or own property in the city. So I think that that senator would be perfectly capable of doing the right thing. But also, this is just something that's in state statute. We have the ability to update that to make sure it reflects what the voters want.
What did you make of the argument that the state control proposal took away local autonomy from city elected leaders?
Well, I mean, I definitely heard from city elected leaders who were concerned about that. But this was one of those bills. It was House Bill 495. And we heard from even before session started that that was one of the governor's top priorities. So anybody that spent any time in Jefferson City knows that when something is the governor's top priority, you don't have a way of stopping the bill. So the best thing you can do is try to make the bill better so that it's not harming people. So, you know, within that omnibus public safety bill that the governor's already signed, there was an increase in restitution for those who were found to be wrongfully convicted. And that includes housing and all kinds of other wraparound services. There's also additional training for racial profiling. There's training for implicit bias. And then also law enforcement officers would get 2 hours of training on de-escalation training. So there's all kinds of things within that omnibus public safety bill that truly will make our community safer and allow for law enforcement to be responsive to the needs of the folks that they are policing.
Another major bill that passed early in session was a wide-ranging utilities bill, which features probably too many things to mention in this particular episode. But the biggest one by far is the construction work in progress measure that would allow companies to raise rates to help build new power plants. This has been in the works for years, though it often ran into bipartisan opposition. Why do you think 2025 was the year for what's known as CWIP?
Well, the cynical part of me could talk about all of the money that flows to politicians during campaigns and such, but I'm not going to mention that. You know, again, Senate Bill 4, which ended up being the omnibus utility bill, that was the first bill that really got any legs, and that got going early in January. So that bill was something that people like me and my colleagues on the other side of the aisle who are always looking for ways to keep people's utility bills as low as possible, there was just going to be no way to stop that bill. We, as a consumer advocate, and I was up against over 100 lobbyists trying to, you know, get their piece of the pie into this bill. So Missouri American Water, Spire, Ameren, they all just had, you know, they came out guns a-blazing as soon as session started. And, you know, that bill to me is the case study of a terrible, terrible bill. And it just every time something else got added to it in the process, it was just getting worse and worse for people that are sitting at their kitchen tables every month trying to figure out what bills to pay. So that was a terrible bill that passed. I ended up voting no on it, but I was able to get some things into that omnibus utility legislation that could help out some of the lowest income people in the state of Missouri.
What were some of those things?
Well, I was able to extend the hot and cold weather rule from 24 hours to 72 hours, which is a big deal in an area like where I live, where we have pretty extreme temperature swings. We want to make sure that the utilities can't turn off somebody's, you know, electricity if there's going to be a 95-degree day coming up in the next 72 hours. So we will be able to keep people alive and healthy because of those new hot and cold weather rules. Also, the consumer advocates, myself included, were able to create a low income discount or rate class, if you will, for Missourians who are most struggling. So that is also a big deal, and we've not had that in the state before. So it would be a low income rate class for people most negatively impacted by rising utility costs.
You were also heavily involved in an effort to raise the marriage age of Missouri to 18. Before this bill, the minimum age was 16 with parental consent. Why did it take so long to do this?
Well, that is an interesting question. Senators Lauren Arthur and Holly Thompson Rader got going on raising the age of marriage to 18 a few sessions ago, and they hit some conservative Republican opposition. So the fact that we were able to raise the age of marriage to 18 for all parties involved is exactly how the process is supposed to work, which is I worked closely with Senator Rick Bratton, who is the head of the Freedom Caucus here in the state of Missouri, and we were able to just have conversations with people and help kind of move the needle on that.
I remember trying to, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm trying to recall a statement that Senator Bratton made on the floor, which was kind of when he was first approached with this idea. He didn't really see a need for it because, you know, he knew relatives that got married, you know, in their teens. And then I remember the quote, if I'm right, was like, that was then and this is now.
Right.
Do you think that was kind of an attitude for why it kind of got through the Senate with really no vocal opposition and had a little bit more of a hiccup in the House? We'll get to that. But kind of thoughts on that kind of evolving mindset on this issue.
I was glad to hear Senator Bratton say that, because all of us that even have a minor interest in genealogy can see in our family trees that people used to get married at a much younger age, but also the average life expectancy only used to be into the mid-40s as well. So, you know, Senator Bratton said something really interesting at a press conference we had about raising the age of child marriage. He said that, you know, a reporter asked him what he would say to his daughters if they wanted to get married before they were 18. And he said he would tell his daughter that if this gentleman loves you enough, he will wait until you turn 18. And I think that was perfectly well said.
We heard some arguments among House members that raising the marriage age could prompt people to get more abortions, because I guess that the logic is if someone is more likely to carry their baby to term if they're married. It was certainly a moment on the House floor. Did you find it compelling?
I did not find it compelling, and we were listening into the House debate when that was going on. I did not find it compelling. In fact, it was quite repulsive. And I think that, you know, that to me is another reminder about why politicians shouldn't get involved in people's private decisions as it relates to, you know, the reproductive choices and their reproductive health care. I just think politicians have no business getting involved in that.
You are a good segueer, because we are now going to delve into the last day of the Missouri Senate session. That's when Republican senators decided to end filibusters aimed at protecting voter-approved abortion rights and paid sick leave initiatives. And you were actually holding the floor with Senator Patty Lewis of Kansas City when Senator Adam Schnelting of St. Charles County forced a vote on the proposal to repeal and replace the abortion rights protections that voters approved in 2024. What was your reaction when that happened?
Well, I still am struggling with the fact that that my Republican politician colleagues decided to so blatantly ignore the will of the voters. And this wasn't just on ending. So last November, the voters voted to end Missouri's abortion ban when they passed Amendment 3. And also Missouri voters at an even higher percentage voted to increase the minimum wage a little bit and allow workers to gradually earn a little bit of paid time. And, you know, the fact that Republican politicians were so eager to ignore the will of voters is just disheartening. You know, they can, the senator from St. Charles can try to, you know, he did cut off the debate and basically told me to sit down and shut up. And that's something that I can take. But I think the voters are really, really frustrated that a handful of politicians in Jeff City can greatly abuse their power and tell these 1.6 million voters that they also need to shut up and sit down and that their vote doesn't matter.
Representative Ian Mackey alluded to this on a recent Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air interview, but he wouldn't have just accepted the 2004 gay marriage ban just because it was the will of the voters. He is gay and married to a very lovely gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
Given that opposition to abortion is such a core philosophical issue among many of your GOP colleagues, did you expect them just not to do anything after Amendment 3 passed?
Well, I thought that they would do something. I find it interesting that a year ago, so in 2024, when the Republicans were trying to make it harder to amend the state constitution, at that time they were so pro-life that they wanted no exceptions, even for women who got pregnant from rape or incest. And in a year's time, they have totally like forgotten what their stance was on abortion exceptions, and now are comfortable with there being exceptions to allow for legal abortion for survivors of rape or incest. So, you know, I knew that they were going to do something. I just the fact that we're not even actually implementing abortion in the state of Missouri, the fact that that's happening now and they're already trying to undo what the voters wanted is just mind-boggling.
And speaking of that, there actually was a ruling by the Missouri Supreme Court that pretty much struck down the preliminary injunction that is allowing abortions in Missouri right now while we wait for the Amendment 3 lawsuit that's scheduled. Is it January, Jason?
I believe it is next year.
Okay. And so I guess thoughts on that particular ruling and kind of what happens next?
Yeah, I saw what the Missouri Supreme Court did. I think that this is just a temporary setback, and it's like a temporary legal setback. I believe that the judge will just grant another injunction that will block the abortion ban and the abortion restrictions. But, you know, big picture, like what we need to realize is how confusing this is for Missourians. So Missourians are unsure. If you just would ask some people on the street, they're unsure what kind of access to health care they can get now in the state of Missouri. And that's simply wrong. We want Missourians, and especially Missouri women, to know that they can go to their doctor, they can go to a health care provider, and have access to the full range of reproductive health care. Women shouldn't have to wonder if they need to travel to another state in order to have access to care that they really need. And so what the Missouri Supreme Court did, I think, was just increase the level of confusion amongst Missourians.
Something on the proposed ballot initiative passed by Republicans on the last day that Democrats took issue with is the ballot summary language doesn't actually say that the proposal would ban most abortions again. And additionally, lawmakers this year passed a bill that restricts how judges can rewrite ballot summaries written by the legislature. Do you think that will complicate efforts to get another summary before voters?
Well, I'm hopeful that the judicial branch will attempt to be honest with Missouri voters when they do go vote. You know, the language in HJR 73 is so deceptive. It doesn't mention that the voters would be voting to undo, you know, to put another abortion ban in place, for example. So, you know, I remain hopeful that the language on the ballot will be honest and let voters know what they're voting on.
But I actually want to ask about another aspect of the ballot summary language that has really caught my attention, and I just cannot shake it. One of the other bullet points says it protects children from gender transition, but this proposed amendment would allow doctors to perform gender transition surgery on intersex children, which makes me think that bullet point is factually inaccurate. What do you think about that, and is it possible that point could be used to completely strike that off the summary, which I think we all know the reason it's there. It's there to gin up turnout among people that don't like trans people. I mean,
yeah,
I'm just not going to mince words on it. Like,
well,
that's the reason.
And what a sad day we're in, where a group of people who are a super minority of people within a minority community are being used as ballot candy. It's just heartbreaking to think that Republican politicians think the only way they can be successful with at the ballot is if they lie and then put a group of people up there to, you know, try to trick and deceive voters. That's just really, really wrong. The other thing to keep in mind, too, is that right now in the state of Missouri, there you cannot have gender-affirming care for minors in the state of Missouri already because of another bill that is in place. And so, you know, this is needless, you know, which is, I guess, the true definition of ballot candy, quite honestly, which is, you know, there's no need to have this.
But I just don't think it's truthful. Like, again, if you can perform gender transition surgery on an intersex baby that's 5 days old, how does this protect children against gender transition? I think that, like, I know this is may seem like a small point, but, like, again, I think that's ripe for legal challenge based off
Of course it is. And, you know, this is exactly why politicians and journalists should not be involved in healthcare decisions.
Journalist? Okay.
The point of my comment is, you know, none of us are experts on what it means to take good care of women and children and Missouri patients. So, you know, this is we should be doing things. We should be honest and truthful and transparent with voters. And all of the language in HJR 73 is deceptive.
What do you think are the prospects for the proposal brought by Republicans on, you know, basically a response to Amendment 3? What is the likelihood of this passing?
Well, I believe that Missourians are not going to want to put another abortion ban in place. So I do think Missourians, the pro-choice people, and that includes Democrats, Republicans, and independents from across the state, there'll be a big educational effort to let voters know that, you know, what the constitutional amendment would do, which is no matter what the words will say on the day you go vote, it's ultimately would put an abortion ban in place in the state of Missouri. And that is a step too far for Missourians. So they will not be successful at the polls.
On the paid sick leave measure, what do you say to Republicans who contend they needed to do something because businesses told them that they would be negatively affected if the paid sick leave requirements went into effect?
Well, politicians should not ignore the will of their voters. And this Proposition A, which would allow for some gradually to earn some paid sick time, that was something that passed in all of the Democratic state Senate districts, but it also passed overwhelmingly in 10 of the 24 Republican state Senate districts as well. So, you know, we as elected officials should not think that we know more and that we are better than our constituents. So, you know, I don't believe that the narrative that businesses were going to close, I don't believe that that was the case.
So Proposition A was passed via state statute. Do you think that this action by Republicans will prompt labor unions maybe to push a constitutional amendment to require paid sick leave? And that could include maybe other things like union protections. Then, you know, overall, this would be harder for the legislature to undo.
Well, I think that, you know, people that care about workers, and these are people, mind you, that keep the economy cranking and going. So these are people that are working in restaurants and factories and dry cleaners, you know, any business that your listeners will visit in an average week. This is what Proposition A was going to do. It was going to affect those people that keep Missouri's economy going. So, you know, a lot of us care about those people because we realize how important they are in our society and in our community. So, you know, we're going to continue to look at all kinds of ideas and proposals to see what we can do to actually help take care of Missouri workers.
I mentioned Representative Ian Mackey of Clayton earlier. I asked him if he thought that Republicans would pay any political price for going after these two voter-approved initiatives. Because if you look on social media, people are enraged by this, even people who I think don't follow Missouri politics that much. Here's his response.
You go back to 1999, we said no to concealed carry. You go back decades, puppy mills. You can go through the list. What happened? Did they face consequences? No. There were people on my street that had yard signs up that said yes on three, vote for Mike Kehoe for governor. Did that make sense to me? Absolutely not. But as long as folks can have their cake and eat it too, I think this is the state we're in. We're in this doom loop where we continue to have proposition after proposition. People get rich off them. They put them on the ballot. They make money off them. The consultants go away happy. And then we just keep this loop going.
That was State Representative Ian Mackey on a recent episode of the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. Pretty harsh words from your Democratic colleague. What do you think about them?
Well, he's not wrong. And, you know, we as Missourians, whether you're involved in politics every day or not, we need to pay as much attention as we can to things that are going on at all levels of government. And I mean all levels of government, school board, city council, your county commissions, all the way up to the legislature and what's happening in D.C., quite honestly, because, you know, the Republicans have been in charge of the state of Missouri now for over 20 years. So things that that I hear complaints about every day when I take calls from my constituents, those are not problems that the Democrats have created in the Missouri legislature. Those are problems that the Republican politicians need to own. So voters need to start paying attention and communicating to people and having conversations with people, because we're not going to be able to get the state out of the mess that it's in without the voters getting more engaged.
Well, Senator, thank you so much for this, I think, phenomenal episode of the Politically Speaking podcast. Sarah, I thought this was phenomenal. What do you think?
Pretty Hall of Famer.
I think it's pretty Hall of Famer. Up there with the Brian Nieves podcast of 2013. That might be...
Before my time, Jason.
it was. I just remembered that existed
I was in college then.
Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is a part of the University of Missouri St. Louis. You can follow all of our stories at stlpr.org. And Senator, Where can people find you on social media where you want to be found?
I am all over social media. It's at TracyMCC3 on Twitter, but I'm also on Facebook and Instagram and Blue Sky.
Oh, Blue Sky. That is a sunny social media platform. We'll be back next time. Until then, so long. Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts.